Welcome to the Bike Show with me, Jack Thurston. Now, if there's one thing that isn't lacking here on the Bike Show, it's variety. From last week's feature on gentle cycle touring with children on the cycle paths of Devon, we turn to something way, way, way off at the other end of the cycling spectrum. That's because in just a few hours' time, around 300 people will be setting off on Europe's most extreme and outlandish long-distance bicycle race. The Transcontinental Race is a test of body, mind and spirit. The format is very simple. It's a single-stage race that begins on one side of the European continent, in Belgium, and ends at the other, in Turkey. Along the way, there are four checkpoints, and the only stipulation is that the riders must go through all of them, and that they're not allowed to accept any kind of outside support. No helpers, no team cars, they're on their own, and the clock never stops. This year, the riders must climb the Puy de Dôme volcano in central France. They must traverse high mountain passes in the Swiss Alps and the Dolomites, as well as venturing into the wild and lonely Dermitor Massif in the heart of the Balkans. The finish is in Çanakkale, the closest modern town to the ancient city of Troy. And apart from the checkpoints, there's no set course at all. Riders must find their own way. And a reasonable guess at the total distance is just shy of 4,000 kilometres. The Transcon, as it's sometimes known for short, is an entirely new format of bike racing, but it's one that has strong echoes of the early heroic era of bike racing. For spectators, it's quite an intriguing race to follow. There's no coverage on TV, but each rider carries a satellite tracking device, and there's a map on the web where you can see each rider's current position, updated in real time. This being 2016, social media plays its part too, with riders' tweets, Instagrams and Facebook updates providing an inside view of the race as it happens. At the front end, the race is fiercely competitive, with riders getting by on very little sleep and covering more than 400 kilometres in a day. But for most, it's much more about testing your own limits, finding out how far you can go. These days in cycling, epic is a word that's used to describe almost anything. But the men and women who complete the Transcontinental have truly earned the right to say they've done something epic on a bike. Earlier in the week, I spoke on the phone to a handful of riders, starting with Christophe Alligate, who won the first two editions of the race and is back in 2016 to take on last year's winner.
Hello, my name is Christophe from Belgium. I started Transcontinental Race for third time this year. First two editions I won the race. So for me, the only thing I can do is do my best. I hope I have a nice time over there. Transcontinental Race is my first love because you're just free, you're alone. You can make the roads you take, you can choose them by yourself, you can choose when you start in the morning, stop for food, stop for a drink, going to shops. Nobody is behind you with a knife, keep going, or you have to cycle that speed. Yeah, you're free. Yeah, it's an adventure with the big letters, and that's the thing I love a lot. You have a couple of big names, even myself having problems on the road, I mean mechanical, mentally, physically, and you have to keep in mind, you always have a couple of underdogs, people who you never heard about, and they just, here I am. My plan for this next week is just to have fun out there. I have trained last year so much, and now it's time to enjoy, no more.
I'm Emily Chappell. I live in mid Wales, though I was in London for a very long time, and this is my second Transcontinental. It's such a huge challenge because it's different every single year. You can't rest on your laurels. Nobody can go at it for the second time knowing they've got it in the bag. Every year it's new. There's no record. There can never be a record because the course changes all the time. And even for people who've done every single one so far, there's going to be unknowns. I'm racing it because I tried last year and didn't finish, so I'm racing it to make sure I can do it. My biggest fear, I think, is not finishing. My race plan is to keep going, basically. I've got an idea of how far I want to go every day and where I want to be and what my targets are, but I've got a secondary plan if that doesn't work out or if I get behind, which is just to keep going, because you're not going to get to the end if you don't keep going, and you're not going to get out of a bad patch if you don't keep going. I'm not going to make any promises about how much I'll be on social media during the race, though there's every chance at some point I want to spend an hour sitting in McDonald's catching up on Twitter. I will be on Twitter at Emily Chapel. I may also be on Instagram, which is Emily of Chapel. And the rest of the time I'll be trying to ignore the world and ride my bike. People are very, very welcome to tweet me encouragements as much as possible. That's what gets me through sometimes.
So my name is James Hayden. I'm from Great Britain, from just outside London. And I raced for the first time Transcontinental last year in 2015. And I had to withdraw from that edition after 6 or 7 days. I had to scratch because of neck issues. And immediately I decided that I wanted to return and race the 2015 edition. The thing that I like most about Transcontinental is just the simplicity of it and the unadulterated nature of a bicycle race, really, and there's no ego to it, there's nothing else, it's just about you, yourself, and the road, and improving yourself to yourself, really, if no one else, and just seeing how good you are, how tough you are, and how far you can go. Preparing for this year versus last year, it's obviously just the second time I've done it, so I've got more experience. Although I didn't finish last year, I learned a lot. And in honesty, going through adversity, you can learn more than you can if you don't have any issues. So there's a lot of things that I picked up on that I can address differently, and obviously the neck and working on that's one thing. And, how I spend my time and, how I sleep and, how I go about the race, really, from the beginning. And the fact that it is quite a long race, although it's, I think it'll be 8 days this year for someone to win it. Still quite a while, and anything can happen, really, and you just got to try and prepare for everything. The tracker and it all going up onto the web is kind of a weird sensation, and you forget about it mostly, but occasionally every now and again when you stop or do something, you have a passing thought that I wonder how many people are watching me do this or who's watching me do that, and it is kind of, you do have that thought occasionally, and you wonder who's watching you and who's following you, and you better hurry up, really, and stop wasting time. People will be judging you.
I'm Stuart Burney. I'm originally from Melbourne, Australia, and I've lived in London for a few years now, and this will be my first transcontinental. I kind of got into long distance stuff through 24-hour time trialing and did all right at that, and then started getting worse at that, so I thought I'd try something different. The new and challenging aspects of Transcon, I guess, are the fact that I'm used to supported racing over 24 hours or Audax format rides, whereas this is completely unsupported or self-supported, and it's also multi-day. We're looking at the very fastest guys are going to finish in 8 or 9 days, I guess, and I'll probably be looking at 10 to 12, I hope, but who knows what could happen. So the multi-day aspect and the fully self-supported aspect are the biggest challenges for me. They're completely out of my comfort zone. My biggest fear about taking part in this crazy event would probably be, it's probably the usual one of cyclists, which is being hit by a car. But my main concern is actually an overuse injury or some kind of injury that stops me from finishing, or maybe I finish but then I can't race for 6 months because I've done so much damage. That's my bigger concern, like some kind of an overuse injury or something annoying that stops me from finishing. My race plan, other than drinking a beer in every country I go through, is to basically ride for as long as I can until I'm too tired to continue, and then find either busy or find a hotel to sleep in, reset for however long I think I need, and then go again and try and get it over and done with as quick as possible. You can follow me on social media. You can follow me on Twitter. I post under First Hippie, Hippie being my nickname.
Those were transcontinental racers Christophe Alligate, Emily Chappell, James Hayden and Stuart Burney. The very best of luck to all of them and to all the other racers in the transcontinental. I hope to take a look at how they're getting on next week with a special transcontinental race update podcast. Look out for it in the middle of next week. Now, as I'll happily admit, racing your bike 4,000 kilometres across Europe is not for everyone. But if, like me, you still like the idea of testing your abilities in route planning, navigation, self-sufficiency, and of course, riding your bike, then Mike Hall and Anna Haslock, who are the organisers of the Transcontinental, have devised a shorter, more accessible event that gives just a flavour of what it's like to ride the Transcontinental. It's called the Valley Cat, and I went along to the second ever Valley Cat that was held earlier this year. About 24 riders made their way to a remote hill farm on the edge of the Cambrian Mountains in the rural heart of Wales. At 7 o'clock on the Friday night, everyone gathered in an old stone barn for the event briefing, which was the moment that Mike revealed the 9 all-important checkpoints scattered across 600 square miles of Mid Wales. Immediately, the riders began poring over maps, plotting routes on computers. Before setting out, one by one, into the cold, dark night. I spoke to a few of them before they went.
So it's kind of split into two loops. I'm going to do the north loop now, and it's about 130 miles.
And you're not going to see much of the beautiful Welsh scenery?
No, no.
But you're going to come back for a good breakfast?
Good breakfast, hopefully.
And so what's your estimate of how long that is going to take you?
It says 8.5, but I asked Mike whether it would take 8.5, and he said maybe in a car, so I'm not sure. I'm going to head into Aberystwyth now to find a petrol station to get some supplies for the night. I've only got a few oranges and bananas left, so that should be fine.
Anything you're worried about? The temperature does seem to be plummeting. Yeah. Anna says it's going to freeze.
You think it's going to freeze?
Yep. That's what we've heard, yep.
I was planning for sort of 5 or 6.
Depends how high you are, I suppose.
I might just take a jumper or something.
Yeah, take a jumper.
You've got to keep moving.
Don't get wet.
I just need to find a 24/7 McDonald's and I'll be fine.
Good luck with that.
Yeah, you have to go to England for that.
Oh, no. Okay.
I'm going to go some places that I've wanted to go for a while, and I'm going to go to some familiar places, and what a weekend for an adventure.
So we're standing by the campfire in the field here, but it's getting darker. You look like you've done some preparatory work on the control sheets here. Are you going to head out tonight, or are you going to head out tomorrow?
I'm going on my gut. I don't think I've eaten enough today. I'm going to eat as much food as I can possibly get down me, then make a decision.
And how about the shortcuts across the mountains on the unsurfaced paths? Are you going to make use of those to cut the distance a bit, or is that going to slow you down maybe?
I may well. I mean, I'm fairly new to 28 millimetre tyres. They've had a thrashing recently, so I'm not scared of doing a bit of off-road nonsense, you know. It's a whole big learning adventure.
So now, 9 o'clock, 9:10, you're going to ride through the night?
Yeah, that's the idea, I'll freeze if I don't. I'll just keep on going to the morning, and then I might rest. I might actually, you know, have some breakfast, sleep. But I don't do riding at night, especially on the road, so this will be a first. And so I need to find out what that's like and how comfortable I am with that. And around here is probably quite a good place, because hopefully it's not too busy.
Well, my plan is to do the southern ones first, and then not to come back here, but to just carry on and go straight into the northern loop. So I'm guessing that's going to get me up to Dalgetty or somewhere like that by sort of dark. So, seeing how, depending on how I feel, either just crack on and ride right through, or try and find somewhere to, you know, to sleep and have a couple of hours in the bivvy. But it was pretty cold last night, so I'm not sure. I really fancy another night out. But yeah, that's the plan. So we'll see how it goes. I mean, to be honest, I just want to have a, you know, a nice weekend out on the bike. I'm not too fussed about how long it takes me or anything. So I don't think my route plan is optimal, if I'm perfectly honest. But I'm not actually that bothered about that. As long as I, you know, have a decent ride and visit some nice parts of Wales, that's all I really care about, to be honest.
It's cold, but it's clear.
Yeah, it was a lot colder this morning. There's still a bit of frost on my bags, but it said that I'll be thawing out soon, hopefully. The faster I go, the quicker it'll come off. But no, it's good. I said it's already like amazing scenery, and just coming in yesterday was really nice. So yeah, it should be good.
So have you done events like this before?
No, as I said, I really want to do like the Transcontinental. So I said like this is probably a good taster to see, you know, if I could do that possibly. So, and I said it's always good at orienteering. I consider myself quite good, but I said I'll find out today if if it all works out.
You got to go to the Lonesome Valley. You got to go and go for you.
Once the riders were all out on the road, I caught up with Valley Cat and Transcontinental race organiser Mike Hall to find out a bit more about the Valley Cat and the whole philosophy of self-supported long-distance bike riding.
The Valley Cat, as best I can describe it, is what you would get if you took an Alley Cat-style event, I should say, not a race, mixed it up with a Brevet or an Audax and took it out into the countryside.
And for people who don't know what an Alley Cat is or what a Brevet is?
Well, a Brevet is a long distance ride where you would ride between control points. Under certain rules, that's over a set course or a known course. An Alley Cat race, on the other hand, is normally around a city, traditionally a bike messenger race, and they wouldn't know the control point locations until they show up and start the race. So they would have to plan and navigate on the fly to be the first to those control points, as if they were making messenger deliveries, and they wouldn't necessarily know where each control point was until they'd been to the previous one, or sometimes they're all disclosed at the start. So you've got to very quickly rationalise your route and pick your priorities and make some judgment calls.
So it's a combination of route planning, navigation and endurance, long distance cycling and survival, self-sufficiency.
Yeah, that's right. And there's a lot of sort of acumen and judgment mixed in there as well. In some of the events, you can navigate quite well because you've got lots of time to prepare in front of computers and technology and so on. And we like to try and break that habit a little bit with a little bit of essence of speed and so on.
So at 7 o'clock last night, you handed out the sheets of paper which had the 9 control points, and everyone suddenly started leaning over maps, going on the computers, sort of beavering away. It was an amazing scene of concentration up in that barn.
Yeah, that's right. It suddenly goes very quiet and you don't know whether people are unhappy or not. Well, they're sort of minds working overtime trying to digest this and what it means and where they're going and what they recognise, what they don't.
It's quite an unfamiliar territory for a lot of people. We're in the heart of Mid Wales, Ceredigion, aren't we, in the Cambrian Mountains on the western edge, but your control points are scattered to the north and to the south, and people have really got to pick a sensible route, and we are sort of in the middle here, so I guess it's possible to do a northern loop around the northern points, come back here, and then sweep up the rest on the next day. Or some people will go out and do one massive ride and spend the night in a bus shelter or a five-star hotel.
That's right, yeah. I mean, it's open to however they want to do it. And if they want to get help, they can ask for it. It's not something we set them up to do as a fail or pass sort of thing. It's purely so that they can, I don't know, exercise their abilities and learn things. Over this weekend, it's a 48-hour event. The first one was a single day or about 12 hours. So we wanted to sort of step things up a little bit and involve an overnight.
So what inspired you to organise these kinds of events? You're the organiser of the Transcontinental. It's going to be into its fourth year this year. You're an accomplished adventure cyclist, endurance cyclist yourself, won prestigious races. You've beat the record for cycling around the world. But here we are in Wales, camped with a couple of dozen people, camped in a field, and you're doing something that is very sort of homespun. And how did you end up being here doing this?
I think Transcontinental has certainly got a lot to do with that. That's grown now so that it's really taking a lot of our time, and it took me away from my full-time job. So not quite being a full-time occupation in itself, we looked at what we could do, maybe to prepare the people who were thinking of doing it, to do something like it, to see if it's for them, and maybe form some kind of domestic version or support group, if you like, for it. But something we'd also like to do is not necessarily put them on ourselves, but to arrive at a format where people can put on their own event in this style around their neck of the woods. Only a third of our participants in Transcontinental Race are UK-based, so we can do them in the UK, but we've got people in Australia and Switzerland and France and Belgium and Germany, etc., that could do this sort of thing in their neck of the woods. And indeed, we've had inquiries from people who want to put on a kind of small version of Transcontinental to get people really in training, because I think it takes an awful lot for them to train to do Transcontinental, and they want events that lead up to it that act as milestones.
So what kind of training do you need to do? Is it physical, is it mental, is it both?
Yeah, it's a little bit of everything. It's probably making a lot of mistakes, I would say. There's quite a lot of logistics and various factors of kit and how you manage your time, and it is quite a nuanced sort of activity if you want to optimise it. There's many things like not standing still and making decisions well but not taking too long to make them, risk mitigation and that sort of thing. So
what is it about you and the way you approach these long distance events that you do that makes you really good at them?
I think it's an idea of completeness, that you aren't necessarily trying to do one job and do it like a robot, that you have to be aware, that you have to be thinking and monitoring things. I believe you make your own luck in a lot of these situations, and I often hear of people who, and it's the same people, that a lot of things happen to them, and then you get people who are the guys at the front who are winning, and for some reason things don't happen to them. Things that might on the surface appear to be beyond their control. But maybe they're not beyond their control, they're just beyond their observation or beyond their monitoring, and they surprise them, and it feels like they are the subject of bad luck, rather than that they've not noticed a situation developing. So if you were to build your own bike and you know it very well and it suddenly starts making a ticking noise, or you drop it on the ground and it rattles, to a person who's built their bike, they know something needs attention there. And I think that idea of completeness of a rider, and I think that was quite important say back in the day, you know, with rider trials, there'd be a lot more pacing and a lot more different attributes that were tested of a rider. And I think, yeah, the whole mindset, I think, of not just treating it like what can my body do, and offloading, again, in the ultra cycling world, offloading a lot of those responsibilities onto others, and you just being the guy who's pushing the pedals.
Because you do seem to have this bifurcation of the long distance cycling racing scene between the supported races, where you've got quite a big operation often behind certainly the top riders, but probably all of the riders have got quite a few people that helping them out, looking after them on their little van or minibus or whatever is going on behind them. And then you've got the self-supported races like the Transcontinental, like the Trans Am, like the Tour Divide, which is a much bigger test because it's just you.
Yeah, I think so. And I think it appeals to the kind of autodidact of cyclists, you know, the people who'd never had a coach, who went out exploring and went out looking to learn and going with that with their eyes open to learn as well. Again, a lot of the people we see that do well at things like Transcontinental are people who have more or less taught themselves what they know. Not necessarily everything, but absorbed knowledge from things, experimented, tested things, gone out and done things for the sake of doing them without wanting to achieve necessarily.
And I'm sure there'll be a lot of people who probably not going to do the Transcontinental or the Trans Am or one of these big long races that takes a fortnight or a month and a really high level of physical commitment that might enjoy doing a Valley Cat. So it's a little bit more open and a little bit more accessible, do you think? Is that the way you want to take it?
Yeah, I think so. The idea is that it's definitely not a competition. If you want to know anything, you can just ask. You can pitch your level of external help and self-sufficiency at what you feel comfortable with. Hope that people will come away from the event with something that they didn't necessarily come to any other event or didn't have before, whether that just be an idea of where they are at any particular place in time, which can be difficult if you're just following a navigation device. You'll see great scenery, you'll have a great ride, and you'll test yourself physically, but you won't necessarily be able to place yourself in the landscape as you ride. Even if you're just riding with a friend and they know the route, it's really easy to switch off when you follow somebody else's route. And I've done it particularly with mountain biking. If you go to a forest and you don't know one end of the forest and you're doing from the other and you do lots of turns, you go on a great ride and then you go back there yourself and you don't know where you went and so on, because you weren't paying attention. And then there's a great feeling of getting to know a place through maps. Like I say, getting to know where you are in the landscape and how it sort of spatially feels around you. And even that can give you a greater sense of adventure. And for this week particularly, you'll feel like you've been across Wales.
Do you think that there's a appetite for this kind of event?
I think there's a certain curiosity, as there is for the Transcontinental race, and an appetite for new things which push people. It is very easy for people to just have things done for them, and that's almost a sense of status in our society. The more things you have other people do for you, the more, you know, worth you are. So when it comes down to a lot of the cycling with the backup team and the team car and getting handed bottles and having your own personal sort of set of servants almost following you around, some people maybe just find a lot more satisfaction in knowing that they can do everything, or not that they can do everything, but they can do an awful lot themselves, and they'll always be all right in any given situation.
As I mentioned earlier, the base for the Valley Cat is a hill farm in the heart of Mid Wales, and the farmer is a man called Dafydd Morris Jones. And as someone who works on the land and whose family has worked on the land for generations, Dafydd is perfectly placed to explain a little bit more about the character of the land, its history, and also his relationship and appreciation of the wider terrain that the riders in the Valley Cat will be discovering for themselves.
My great-grandparents moved here in 1883. The farm itself existed as an entity for a couple of hundred years before that, and then existed as a smaller farm for about 500 years before that. So I'm now the fourth generation here. We were tenant farmers to begin with, tenants to the Havard estate. The lower half of the farm used to belong to another estate. It was lost in a card game sometime in the mid-1800s. So half the farm was bet on a card.
So Mike and Anna have scattered the control points all around the Cambrian Mountains, right up as far as the southern edge of Snowdonia National Park. So the riders who've come here for the weekend will have got a tremendous sense of the landscape in which you're farming. Can you describe a bit the landscape and the uses to which the land is put?
Yeah, I mean, the landscape itself is quite different to any of the sort of topography you'd be used to in North or South Wales. It's that the central massif is a big upland plateau that tends to be, by now, predominantly sort of millennia and upland moor. The moorland is retreating somewhat as Molinia sort of keeps its onward encroachment and then marches on to take over those areas. But then where we are now, the farm is right on the edge of that plateau. So you get these lovely deep river gorges with sessile oak woodlands. And then you get the sort of marginal farmlands where on the whole now it's sheep husbandry that sort of keeps that in the state it's in. And then as you rise to the top of the plateau, you get areas where sheep have been taken away, which is where you get the millennia, and then you tend to get these very big blocks of Forestry Commission woodland as well.
Because on the one hand, it's a very empty place, it's very sparsely populated, it's the most sparsely populated part of Wales, isn't it, the Cambrian Mountains. But the land is heavily contested in terms of land use, and you've got farming, forestry, wind turbines. Used to have a bit of mining going on.
Well, quite a lot of mining. I mean, the sparseness of the population is something that realistically has only existed for the last sort of 80 to 100 years. When the lead mining industry was at its peak here, this was quite a heavily populated area. The villages were all quite a lot bigger than they appear today. And the areas that by now seem quite desolate, bleak and out of the way were villages, were small hamlets, and were sort of mining communes more than anything. There were some places that were cooperatively run. There were a lot run by the larger landowners because it was mainly upland estate ownership that sort of operated these areas. They had the mineral rights as well. The Crown played a big part in land ownership. Cwmsum Log Mine, which is about 5 miles away from here as the crow flies, produced all the silver to fund the Royalist Army during the English Civil War. So there have been some very big interests at play for a very long time, and it's only very recently that those interests have retreated and have taken the people with them, you know.
It's a very distinctive landscape around here, but it's distinctively indistinct, I think, to an outsider view. And the riders who are out on the roads over this weekend will be getting to grips with it and finding it challenging to make their navigational decisions, because it's not like you've got these very clear mountains from which you can orient yourself. The mountains are, I'm not sure that they count as mountains. They look like sort of lumpy hills, and to my eye, they look the same, but I'm guessing that you have a whole different perspective on it because you live and work in this landscape. Tell us about the beauty of this landscape.
You know, I think it's got a rugged beauty that surpasses all others. I've spent a lot of time. I've worked in many sort of upland areas in the UK as an outdoor instructor. I've worked out in the Alps a little bit, and it's I far prefer this area. It's got a bleakness to it that's so beyond bleak it's beautiful at times. And in the middle of summer, when you get the swathes of sort of moor grass at the top there, it's like being next to the seaside. You can find a lovely beach next to a little tarn. But I think the way that you navigate the landscape's different to the way that you'd navigate anything in Snowdonia or even sort of the Peak District, anything in the Brecon Beacons, because when you look at the old names for places, you look at the field names, you look at the place names, they refer to very small objects. They refer to a small collection of stones. They refer to a little dell or a cleft in a rock. And you get beauty and places of note on a far smaller scale. It's more sort of it's more contained in a way, but then between them you've got these vast expansive distances that mean that you're sort of macro-naving, not micro-naving. You've got points in the distance that you can aim for if there isn't any mist, and you've got then a relatively featureless terrain if you're not looking for the features. But if you look for them, I mean, the place is pockmarked with industry. You've got leats that control the water system for most of the uplands that were carved in for the lead mining industry over 300 years. You can follow a leat to an old lead mine site and then follow the track out of that site to get yourself anywhere. And all you need to do is find a bog that looks a little bit like it was a reservoir once. But you need to know these things.
Another feature of the landscape is the reservoirs, and those are marketed to outsiders as wonderful, sublime sites to come and visit, whether it's the dam, these huge Victorian constructions out of great big lumps of stone, utterly spectacular to look at, or the huge expanses of water. But there is a kind of sadness about a reservoir, isn't there?
Yeah, there's a stillness to them. When you realise what's lying underneath that beautiful, pristine surface, I mean, like if you read Aris Thomas's Reservoirs or anything of that sort, you begin to see that the depths underneath are nowhere near as beautiful as the top is. There's a lovely video of a diver going through a reservoir that I think is at the top end of the Brecon Beacons, and he's diving through a cemetery and diving between the gravestones, and you've got that community whose dead won't ever see the light of day again. I know that the dead themselves won't, but you can't go and visit your family anymore. There's somebody's great-grandparents whose gravestone they're never going to be able to trace, regardless of how much of their family history they go through. You've got whole communities that have just vanished under those very, very still waters.
And the valleys that have been filled with water were the most beautiful parts of the country. The Elan Valley markets itself with the writings of Shelley, and his writings about the Elan Valley were when it didn't have a reservoir.
Yeah, I mean, the unfortunate thing about reservoirs is that you have to put your dam wall somewhere. They tend to be blind valleys with very narrow entrances to them, the sorts of places that would have been quite sheltered, that would have had a little microclimate of their own as a result, that would have been quite distinct from the areas around them. So almost by necessity, you end up flooding the prettiest place you can find. The Elan Valley, as an example, was taken because it happened to be at about the same level as Birmingham, so that you could run a pipeline without needing to pump it from there to the other end. And it was chosen purely for that purpose, which seems like quite a mercenary way of assessing which bit of landscape you want to drown, really.
I don't like massive conifer plantations because I find them ugly blots on the landscape, scary, nasty places with no life in them. You don't like large coniferous plantations. Tell me why you don't like them.
Conifers, quite apart from being dark and silent in an ecological perspective and from a sort of from a landscape and possibly an aesthetic point of view, they're quite dark and quiet places culturally as well. They lie over land that would have supported families. Those families would have gone to the local schools. They'd have kept the pubs open. They lie over places where people would have lived and worked. And when the Forestry Commission first came to the area, there was a big push to try and convince the local population that it was a new way forward for the countryside, that it was something that would bring another economy to the area, that would replace the income that they'd recently lost through lead mining leaving. When in fact all they did was they actively evicted people from their farms. They basically gave tenants who were estate tenants up until that point the choice of finding a mortgage in a year or moving out. And as soon as they moved out, they planted all the farmland. They planted right up to the edges of the stone walls for the houses and left the houses empty. In the same way, linguistically, the Cambrian Mountains have always acted as a bit of a barrier and a border between English-speaking Wales and Welsh-speaking Wales. And the side of the mountains they chose to plant moved the linguistic border 24 to 30 miles westwards, which has really marginalised the Welsh language and stopped that interplay between the communities on the eastern and western side of the mountain. So it stopped the Welsh language possibly regaining some of the areas that it lost when it was being actively persecuted.
What is the state of health of the Welsh language, do you think?
I mean, I think officially the numbers are rising. The rise of Welsh language education in South Wales has certainly helped. There's another aspect to it whereby I think for a language to be vibrant and living and to be part of your culture, it needs to have some economic and cultural use beyond just learning it at school. If you can't use it at work, then what's the point in having it? And if you don't use it at home, what's the point in having it? It's something that I think is very closely linked with agriculture. The agricultural industry in this area and throughout most of Wales operates through the medium of Welsh. And it means that it necessitates Welsh-speaking vets, Welsh-speaking feed merchants, Welsh-speaking agricultural mechanics, accountants, solicitors, and all the other multiplier industries that you get associated with it. The same doesn't exist in the other industrial areas of Wales, because those were areas where industry was almost deliberately imposed as being English-speaking. You weren't allowed to speak Welsh down the mines because it was seen as a safety issue, because your Cornish comrades wouldn't be able to understand if you shouted something out. And it's an industry which ties you to your land, so you have a population of farmers that tend not to move around because they can't take their farm with them. It's not the same as having a population of engineers or a population of teachers, and in that sense it geographically ties the language as well.
Tell us about your sheep, because they look different from many of the other sheep that you might see around Wales. They look like they've been drinking out of a bucket of very dark ink. They've got their lovely markings.
Yeah, yeah, the hill speckles. They're the result of primarily breeding by an estate owner called the Duke of Newcastle, but then a lot of selective breeding after that. There's some Scottish blackface in them, there's some Welsh mountain in them, and the breed's existed for a fair few hundred years now. We think they're particularly suited to our farm. We're south-facing. They're not very good on north-facing hills. They make very good mothers for the lambs. They produce a lot of milk for their body size. And they're capable of producing a fair amount of milk off some quite rough grass. We think their grazing pattern's quite good for the habitat as well. They tend to blanket graze a lot less than Welsh mountain sheep. So they create tussocks and tufts in their grazed pasture, which works really well on the heather mountain. The sheep tracks create quite a diverse flora that benefits more than just the sheep. So yeah, they're really nice sheep. They're really good. They're not nowhere near as lively as Welsh mountains either, so the fences don't need to be quite as strong to keep them in one place.
And what is the market for the meat? Where do they go? Where do they end up?
By now, the speckle is a rare breed. Some of our market, possibly up to 50% of it, is for continued breeding rather than for meat. They make a very good crosser. So if you take a hill speckle and take it to a lowland farm and cross it with a larger breed, it'll make a very good mother for the larger lamb it'll produce. So our females tend to go on for breeding. And that's another part of, I think, the agricultural cycle that isn't quite understood. The uplands don't just produce meat. They produce breeding stock for the lowlands who produce meat. So our speckles end up there. And then in terms of meat, they end up primarily with supermarkets, which is unfortunate. They tend to drive the price down as far as they possibly can. The price is based on how many lamb chops will fit in a plastic packet, not on the quality of the meat. It's also based on whether or not the cuts seem to be of the right weight. And to me, in some ways, I think lamb has its place in the food chain, but I think hoggets, brilliant. I don't understand why we're not eating more stuff that's a year old, why we're not letting meat mature, and why we're not letting animals grow to their fullest extent before we consume them. I think it's a little bit perverse that way as well.
So now this is going to sound like an incredibly towny question, but cycling around at this time of year in the springtime when you've got lambing and you look over the fence and you see the field full of the frolicking lambs and that kind of whole mammalian mother child thing is so evident in the way that they behave to each other and the kind of nurturing instinct of the mothers and the playfulness and the vulnerability of the lambs. You can see where this is leading. It's at this time of year that I feel like I really need to become vegetarian because they're just so sweet. They're so adorable. Do you not ever feel a kind of pang of sadness about these creatures that they're destined for the abattoir?
Well, like I said, half of our flock isn't destined for the abattoir.
Well, that helps.
Which really does help because, you know, I'd like to think that they're born to live, not born to die, you know? But I think, on the whole, if you were to see them in late summer when the mothers have got bruised udders, are really fed up with them, their hips aren't quite working as well as they did because they've been clouted by a lamb that's almost the same size as them and they're desperate for them to leave the field, you wouldn't feel that mammalian mother-child thing quite exists to the same extent. And the look of relief on a sheep's face when the lambs have finally been taken away is palpable. So in that sense, I think it's slightly misleading when the lamb's so much smaller and cuter than the sheep is. I myself, I don't eat a massively meat-ridden diet. I think meat's got its place in the food chain. I don't think it's necessarily a staple. That doesn't mean that it should replace pulses or vegetables or anything else. I think this is just a very good way of letting people eat grass.
That was Dafydd Morris-Jones, on whose farm the Valley Cat took place and in whose camping field we all stayed. And a very nice camping field it was too, not least because of all the good company, the food and drink and the roaring campfire. And I spoke to Anna Haslock, who's the other half of the Valley Cat and Transcontinental Race organising team, while she was stirring a giant pot of vegetarian chilli. We're in the HQ. There's a fire outside, campfire, everyone's sitting around in the evening light. And here you've made a kind of army-style mess tent with an incredible range here. And some tables made out of, big table made out of pallets.
Yep.
It's very atmospheric, very rustic.
Yeah, it feels quite homely. And our volunteers helped us set this up really. So Jim made the table, Dav built me a little bar there, and this brilliant two hobs. Apparently, got those for a quid each. Set all this up. So yeah, it feels nice and homely. We got some lights, some candles. Makes it quite atmospheric.
And in the other half, behind the curtain there's the flop house. for people who come without tents.
Yeah, that's where people could. Well, last night it was, I think it was -2, so some people crept in even though they had tents. And then one guy, Stefan, he arrived, no tent, no bivvy. So he was in there as well. And yeah, it's just a little space for people to, if they need a little rest and somewhere to go and be private if it's all been a bit too much. So yeah.
So is that sort of part of the intention of the event, is to make it friendly and sociable and not just about riding your bike, although obviously there's a lot of riding your bike that has to go on.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, we want it to be about people. We want it to be about, you know, people being able to chill out and chat to each other. And all these people clearly, will get on because they all love cycling. So, you know, everyone's going to get on. So you just make a nice, relaxed space for people to enjoy themselves and, you know, be able to relax after doing something really difficult. So, you know, you just be as friendly and helpful as you can. And hopefully, well, it seems to work. People seem to like it. So, yeah.
And you've been, as well as stirring the chili pot here and everything else, you've been pumping out images and commentary about the event as it's been going on through the day. How important is the sort of storytelling part of a Valley Cat?
That's really important to me and Mike. That's kind of that's what we do, really, is we tell stories. So the people who come to our events, they are the story, and we just watch, notice the stories and try and tell the stories. And we found that because the stuff we do is very visual. We've worked with these wonderful photographers on the TCR. James came with us last year, and Camille, and James is here with us today. Their images are just absolutely beautiful and really capture what we're trying to do. So
do you think that's kind of where you're marketing the events, essentially, to future participants, is getting it out there on Instagram and making it look like, wow, I want to be at the next one?
Yeah, that's what
I guess, putting big adverts in magazines is not your style or budget.
Well, yeah, it's a bit beyond us budget wise at the moment, but yeah, I don't think we need to. I think that's the wonderful thing for small businesses. Social media is just enables you to speak directly to your potential customers, and it's about, yes, obviously we want more people to find out about it and come and join in, but we also want people to who can't but who would just love to follow along. The TCR, there's so much of a community developed around that's where a lot of our ability to put on these events has come from the wonderful community that is surrounded the TCR. And they're so supportive, they're so keen. We just sort of spend our evenings just thinking up new projects so we can think up something fun for them to do, so it's brilliant fun. Yeah, really enjoy it.
It's not a race, it's not a competition, but we have the first person back who's done all the controls. Congratulations.
Thank you. It was great fun.
You've been out for how long?
I think it's about 22 hours.
Did you set off at
9:30? Yeah.
As the frost was forming on the hillsides.
We only had 2 hours of actual reasonable temperature. After that, the rest, the other 20 hours, I was freezing, various levels of freezing. If I was freezing because it was night time and the temperature was below zero, or I was freezing because the wind, even in the sun, I was freezing. It just didn't seem to warm up. It's amazing cold air mass out there. It was pretty hardcore, the temperature. I wouldn't want a bivvy out there. Poor guys that are bivvying with one season sleeping bags. Those are going to suffer. Total distance was 349, and I reckon climbing probably was just under 7,000. But when I first planned it, the climbing was more like 6.5. And
you added a bit in extra, just for good measure.
I think I probably did. And the last control point, which is number one, was a bit of a shock because it was a 25% climb there, which I had not really kind of anticipated. It would have been all right if it had gone the other way because that would have been the first thing I did. but the last thing I did was a 25% climb.
That was the Devil's Staircase. So you left the best till last, the worst till last.
Well, yeah, it was like not really knowing anything, just following the computer. And so suddenly I was looking at this thing, I was like, God, there's a motorbike up there. Oh my God, how do they get up there? And then I realised that I'm about to go up that thing. And it just didn't stop. Yeah, it's horrible. If it had been 10 degrees warmer, the riding at night around the bits we were doing, no cars whatsoever, yeah, that would have been really good at, you know, a bit warmer, but...
I think you need to get some hot food inside you.
Yeah, okay.
Well done.
All right, thanks.
Since Craig came in, we had a few more riders come in. None have completed all the control points, but many are warming themselves around the campfire, which is impressively large and noisy. So is this a good moment to have a kind of campfire recap on where everybody's got to? You've had a look at the trackers. Is everyone safe?
Everybody appears to be safe here. We've got two riders that are not at camp. That's Robert Thompson, who appears to be in a hotel. So he's nice and safe and warm. And
not just any hotel.
A nice hotel on the overlooking Lake Verney. He's
gonna hotel and spa.
Hotel and spa. Yeah, nice big Victorian hotel. Oh, it does look quite pleasant actually. A change to the sub-zero temperatures at camp. But
or sleeping in a toilet like Joe did last night.
Yes, I think that put paid to his aspirations to complete everything in one go.
And who's the other? Who's the other? Who's out on the loose?
Mike Sheldrake, who is a former transcontinental finisher, and also raced last year and didn't finish. Yeah, I think he knows what he's doing. He's been past our location earlier on this evening, so he did have the option of coming back, and he's obviously chosen to go on. So.
Pushing on through the night.
I believe so. Yeah, he's somewhere near the Star at the moment.
And a few withdrawals through bad knees and things like that.
Yeah, I think possibly a few people didn't quite realise how lumpy it is in Mid Wales, or certainly how persistently lumpy it is, which is always good to find out. But everyone appears to have done what they feel is enough. Some will be back out tomorrow. Some might take some waking up and getting going, but everyone appears to be in good spirits.
For the last word on the second ever Valley Cat, I'm going to hand over to Dave Han, a cyclist from Cardiff.
Massive navigational errors, right? But complete joy. Just loving it all the way around. Every moment, really, really good. Even the brutal climbing and the... Oh my God, I don't know which valley I've gone down now. Voyage of discovery. Really, really good. So, for Mike to put this event on by making us go to some obscure places, bits of Wales that... There's always going to be new bits of Wales, but fantastic bits of Wales that I saw yesterday. So, yeah, super happy.
If all that's piqued your interest, there will be another Valley Cat, Valley Cat 3, at the same location on September 16th to the 18th. And you can register and find out more about putting on a Valley Cat in your part of the world on the website, valleycat.cc. Thanks for listening to The Bike Show. Tune in again in the middle of next week for an update on the Transcontinental. Until then, from me, Jack Thurston, goodbye.
But I'm out on the road again. I'm on the road again. But I'm so tired of crying. But I'm out on the road again. I'm on the road again. I ain't got no woman just to call my special friend. You know the first time I traveled out in the rain and snow. In the rain and snow. You know the first time I traveled out in the rain and snow, in the rain and snow. I didn't have no pharaoh, not even no place to go. And my dear mother left me when I was quite young, when I was quite young. And my dear mother left me when I was quite young, when I was quite young. She said, Lord, have mercy on my wicked son. Don't you cry no more, don't you cry no more. Take a hint from your mama, please. Don't you cry no more, don't you cry no more. Cause it's soon one morning down the road I'm gone.
Hello, this is Emily Chappell, and this is my first dispatch from the grand endurance effort that is the preparation for the transcontinental race. So today it's been a real day of ups and downs. I spent hours, like countless hours, in the same aero position, sitting in front of my laptop, writing my final blog post, and the repetitive strain of ticking off every item on the to-do list is starting to give me carpal tunnel syndrome. But I powered on through, and I came through the dark places and then came into the final straight, the final tweaks of the ride with GPS routes that I've planned. And then it all happened. Ride with GPS crashed, and I got it going, and then it crashed again, and then it crashed again, and I lost my route, and then it lost my route again. And you know, you've just got to keep it together during these times. So I kept going because that's what you got to do. And eventually I gave up and just let it route whatever way it wanted, because I thought, you know, what's the worst that can happen? And finally closed the laptop, and here I am now.